Good afternoon, everyone. It's 12:45, and I'm 2 minutes late to get started here. So my name is Peter Provost. I'm a program manager with Visual Studio ALM Tools. And Jim Newkirk asked me to come and talk to you guys a little bit about kind of the staying in the groove aspect of software development. So I work on the Visual Studio team, as I said. So we're going to have a little bit of an agenda that kind of goes like this. We'll look through a bunch of different points that I think are kind of important for the Agile developer. I'll tell you to kind of take you through kind of some of the interesting aspects of each of those. But for those of you, for the four of you in the room who maybe don't know who I am, let me kind of start here. So I've been with Microsoft for a little while. And you know what? This is not actually what Jim wanted me to do. Hold on a second. There we go. Mic's back on now. So in order to give you the Agilista robe and sandals talk, I had Jim get me a robe. So I'd tie my little string on here. And I'd keep the hood up, but it's kind of weird. Right? I guess I could do this. And now you guys can't see me anymore. All right. So from here on out, I'm not going to be talking to you as Peter Provost, the Visual Studio Microsoft Program Manager. I'm going to be talking to you as Peter Provost, the Agilista nerd who's been hacking at this stuff for 25 years, doing Agile since before it had that name, hanging out with Agile-minded people. A little bit about me then to get rolling. So I told you I work for Visual Studio ALM Tools, but I live in Denver, Colorado. So if you've ever heard people talk about doing Agile in a distributed or a remote fashion, yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. Because I do it every day. I've been doing it now for 4 years, successfully. Grew up all over the world, in fact. Lived in Egypt and Nigeria and all kinds of places. My dad was in the oil business. Started programming when I was about 9 years old. Play in a rock and roll cover band. Kids, dogs, karate, all kinds of other fun stuff. A little about me there. Now, I said I started programming when I was nine. So our very first computer was actually something that looked like that. And this is about when I was 8 or 9, maybe 8. And I remember I was not very tall. My dad had this workbench, and I'd go up to the workbench, and I want to know what he was doing. So I'd put my hands up like this, and I'd try to pull myself up. And of course, no, I'd always end up getting my hands on the soldering iron. Not nice, right? Just to see what he was doing. And this is what I saw. It was insanity. I couldn't figure it out. Turns out he was wire wrapping his own computer. You guys heard of wire wrapping? Okay, you just said you're old. So after that, I mean, my dad had fun with it and toggle switches and all that other good stuff. But after that, he went and bought one of these, an Ohio Scientific Challenger 4P. And this is when I actually first started kind of programming. I didn't know what I was doing really yet. But I was typing in these things from the manual. Like the instruction manual came with programs in it. You typed those in, figured out what you were doing. From there, we went to an Apple II Plus. Initially, we didn't have those two gigantic floppy drives, but we later got them. And this is really when I started to code. Because we lived in Egypt at the time. And so no TV, talking Egypt in the 80s, no TV. And so all I had was this computer to play with. And we would get the magazines, and everybody who would go back to the States or visitors and travelers would come back. They knew they had to bring me new magazines with code in them. And I would type them all in and debug them and hack them. And I'm still convinced, they say this, that I learned my instinctive ability to kind of see and understand a program that way that is not modeling or code or debugging or diagnostics. I learned it hacking these terrible Apple BASIC programs, trying to find the syntax error that I put in when I was typing in, you know, like this. And of course, I didn't really know how to type. We went on, and we had this crazy hybrid machine that could switch back and forth between a Z80 and an Apple. Remember that 1 year that Apple allowed clones? right? And you could go back and forth. And that was when I first got my experience with CPM, and I started looking at new programming languages and stuff. Of course, we eventually went on to PCs, and I continued down that road with a whole host of them. Pretty much Wintel all the way up to what I have today, right? Which is a home-built machine with a stand-up desk and three monitors, although I'm thinking about putting three more on the wall behind, above them. So I've been hacking at computers as long as I can remember. I can't really help it. And I remember when I first discovered Agile, I was in the consulting business, one of these middle things here, and we did a lot of Java work in addition to C++ stuff. And I had the Java Programming Journal. And on there it said XPN Java. And I thought, ooh, this is a cool new framework. I'll have to go try this. And it wasn't. It was all about process. Well, and I'd been struggling to deal with figuring out process stuff. Because I kind of was leading our shop. We were a small company, and I was just kind of the guy who, when presented with a leadership void, will jump into it. So started looking at what XP was all about and learning, and it was one of those things where the moment I read it, I said, well, duh, that makes sense. So immediately started driving our shop to think about software development this way. Test-driven development and things like that, just immediately, as soon as I saw them, I just said yes. And I don't know why. But it felt right from the moment I looked at it. Probably because, my dad was, I told you he was in the oil business, so he was a hard rock geologist, scientist person. Everything he looked at was science and hypothesis and experimentation. And in fact, TDD is a lot like that, so it all kind of naturally fit. So, on about 2004, Jim calls me up and says, hey, do you want to come work for me on the P&P team? And for any of you guys who've been coming to these summits and coming and seeing us do this kind of thing for a while, you probably remember talks that I've given here where I showed you our cool P&P team rooms. You maybe even have been over there and seen them, right? We really got to do some amazing exploration of embracing XP and Agile stuff. And so I've got a lot of interesting stories and things to share with you about the kinds of things it takes to really get a team to gel and to fit and to be successful. And since then, at P&P, I've now been in Visual Studio for 4 and a little bit years. And as you can imagine, that's a little bit of a different environment. But it's been really nice to participate in these last 4 years in helping these teams of people go from where we were to the kind of Agile processes that we're using now across all of Visual Studio that are letting us do the kinds of things we're doing. So, take that old agenda that I had before I had the robe on, and let's kind of go through this from a different perspective, and a different approach. And also, since some of you claim that all of you know me, you also know that I don't mind questions, I don't mind hecklers, I don't mind hands up. So go for it. All right. All right.
One thing with questions is we are recording it, so I will come around and bring the mic.
Okay, or I can just repeat it and we can do our best. All right. Yeah, these whole Peter Interactive talks aren't always very nice to the recording systems, but it's going to be fine. Okay, so I'm going to start with one that I think is an extremely, maybe the most important aspect to having a team gel, fit together, come together, and deliver software, and deliver anything. And it's fun. And I'm really not kidding when I say this. I mean, do any people on your software development team, do you think the people on your team say to each other or to their spouses or their friends or the people on their soccer or softball teams over the weekend, I love my job. I love going to work. It's great. Now, I say that and people think I'm crazy. Right? When I go to band practice, I'm sitting there rocking out in my band, and people, they're talking about how they hate their job or hate the next thing. I'm like, I don't know, man, I'm looking forward to Monday. It's going to be great, right? I love what I do, and when you get a team to get to that place, it completely changes your capability. You will be a completely different team in terms of what you can deliver, how fast you can deliver it, the quality of what you deliver, the delight you'll bring to your customers, if everybody just loves it and has a good time. Click. This picture is a really interesting one. So this is from a marketing or advertising firm in Jakarta. And I went looking around and found all these amazing photos of places. And I thought this was just so cool. They have a slide that goes from the second floor to the first floor. I mean, if you're ever even slightly bummed out there, all you got to do is go up the stairs and come down the slide. You know what I mean? And suddenly you're in a good mood and you want to go work on a project again. It's funny little things. I mean, there's most of the aspect of loving what you do and having fun is really cultural, personal, social, right? It's being respectful to each other. It's being trusting of each other, open, honest, all those communication things that you'll hear us talk about. Those are hugely important to fun. But there's also just a little bit of, you know, actually have some fun. You know, Nerf wars are great. You know the Nerf guns? So I told you I'm in Denver, right? So it means I'm always on video. I probably do 6 hours plus a day on video calls to here to Redmond. And it happens all the time that I'm on a video call and the guy I'm talking to, the door opens up behind him and a hand comes in and somebody pops him in the back with about 4 Nerf guns and takes off again, right? That's fun, right? And people love coming to work. They love participating. And this then sets that emotional space inside of your body, inside of the whole team, to want to delight. You want to delight your peers, your colleagues, your stakeholders, your customers. You want to just go because you're having fun all the time, right? This one's, I can't tell you how to make this happen, except that you'll know when it's happening and you should continue to do whatever it is that's making you feel that way. Different cultures, different teams, different countries, a lot of different things contribute to what fun can mean. But if you start finding yourself stifling fun, stop doing that, okay? If you really want to get a team that gels, that comes together as a single group that really wants to deliver great, amazing products, let this one happen. A lot of managers struggle with this one sometimes. You know, they think we've got to, especially over here in the U.S., you know, we got to focus on the efficiency. We got to get everybody hardcore. Nah, have a good time. You'll do better in the long run. We'll talk about long run in just a minute. How about now? So there's this interesting thing that happens in Agile that sometimes gets called last responsible moment or just in time or all these other kinds of things. There's this interesting, the problem here is kind of the difference between long-term and short-term thinking, right? They're both really good at certain aspects of the problem, and they have a huge impact on the way your team interacts, reacts, contributes, participates, how they come together as a unit. You might not think it does, but consider some of these things. We all hate it when we get to this position of analysis paralysis, right? We're spending all our time in meetings, designing, arguing, bickering, negotiating, drawing pictures, drawing models. Damn it, we should just start writing code, right? That's true. But also, there's a certain amount of you have to balance the short with the long. So just-in-time planning, just-in-time definition, estimation, design, I love all of these things. But the most important thing is remembering that just-in-time does not mean just too late. Okay? There is a point where you cross the line. And finding that point is a challenging thing to do because for every kind of a work that you're effectively deferring, it has its own unique point in time where you're waiting too long. So for example, if we're talking about, you know, defining a story for our team, you know, getting the specification of it, they're drawing mock-ups of it, click-throughs, acceptance criteria, maybe just demo scripts, whatever. Well, if you wait until, you know, 10 minutes before a planning meeting, you probably waited too long. If you did it 4 months ago, you did it too early, right? If you wait to write tests for your system until, you know, after the entire team's completely code complete and you've been coding for 9 months, you waited too long, okay? If you try to write all 4,000 tests for your system before you've written a single line of code, that's probably too early. And so finding that point is important. And so that's kind of the short-term side of it, right? Try to stay focused short, but focus short appropriately. But you can't forget long. The long view matters. Remember, I'm here talking to you about team, about people, about making the team come together, making us be kind of a whole, making us deliver effectively. Turns out that when people don't have a sense of the long, they do poorer. They care less. They have less fun. They stress, they get angsty, they're worried. They'll start to over-engineer. That's the neat one I've observed, is that if they don't see the long picture, they will start to over-design and over-engineer the product because they don't know where it's going. So anything could happen, right? So they get carried away. So you've got to always be in a position to give people the long view. Give them the opportunity to see the long game, to focus on the long game. But when you're planning and making decisions, you want to try to defer those up until that last responsible moment without waiting too long. And when you do wait too long, acknowledge it, call out, learn from it, and move on. That being in the dark thing can be a killer. So, you guys know I like to throw out crazy quotes, and I particularly like quotes from military guys like Patton and Eisenhower, because they said some good stuff. You know, a good plan violently executed. That's great, isn't it? Love the fact that he said violently in there. It wouldn't have been nearly as good a quote without it. Violently executed now is better than a perfect plan executed in a week. Clearly, he's talking about a military perspective. But it applies very, very accurately, right? Violently executed. Go into it with passion, with energy, with excitement, with courage, and get it done, and then replan. Instead of spending weeks, days, hours, too many weeks, days, hours, doing too much planning. Do the right amount and get in there. Kill stuff. Kill bugs, kill bites, kill pixels, whatever it takes. Get it done. That sentence really kind of sums it up nicely for me, this short-term, long-term thing. Because even in a war setting, like he was describing a World War II kind of a setting, right? Even in that kind of a setting, the guys on the ground knew whether they were, you know, going in through Italy or going in through France, right? I mean, they knew where they were going, right? They knew what the long picture looked like. The picture was, you know, the Allied War or whatever. And they had that long picture. They had a sense of it. They didn't know every single detail along the way, but they knew what the objective was. They knew what the goal was. They could have that energy and passion. Your teams have to have that too. But don't go too far. Don't over plan. Now, that engagement, that passion, all right, having fun's great. That'll help us get there. But there's kind of that thing about how do we make people care, right? How do we get people to actually care about what it is we're doing? Because if they don't care, they can be having fun, they can see the long road, and they just don't care. You know, we're not really in the place we need to be. We need to figure out how to get them to care. You want your teams to be passionate about what it is you're doing and how it's contributing. Now, different people get motivated in this slightly differently. Some people might say, how is it contributing to my business? How is it contributing to making the world a better place? How is it contributing to changing the world, right? That's some of the stuff that Steve Jobs was doing when he was getting his people all excited over there at Apple was he had everybody pretty damn convinced that they were changing the world. That's cool stuff. Right? You will be engaged and passionate if you actually think you're changing the world. And you've got to try to find those opportunities to take your team, to take your people, take your colleagues and friends, and get them to that place. Get them to that place of excitement. And that long road picture is an important part of it. So we've got to have fun so that we can, you know, every day is good. That long road picture helps us see what the road looks like. Now, tell me why that road matters. Get me excited about that road. Now we're starting to get somewhere. We're starting to get to this place where the whole team is starting to come together and, you know, they can't wait for the alarm clock to go off in the morning because they know they're changing the world, right? They're helping us make some number of billions of dollars or contribute to some charity or whatever it might be. So take a second and think, right? And it doesn't have to be a work thing. Right, it might be something you were doing at home. Maybe you're remodeling your kitchen. You're changing a transmission on your Chevy. Right? You're painting a fence, whatever. Something you cared about. You really wanted it this way. And think about how it changed the way you worked on that project as opposed to all the other things that we have to do as part of our daily lives that you just do because you have to do them. I'm not passionate about taking out the garbage on Sunday. Okay? That's not one of those ones that I'm going to get really excited about and go nuts over. Right? But when I built that cool multi-tiered stand-up desk, I cared about that. I spent, you know, I was drawing pictures and parts, and my wife said I was, you know, just laser focused on that for, you know, a day while I made that one thing I really, really cared about. And I love that stupid desk. It's just a desk, right? But I really cared about getting it done, and I wanted it to be just right and perfect. And so, you know, I went all that extra mile. And if you think about times when you've done that, you know what I'm talking about. We've got to figure out how to get our teams to that place where they care. I know I'm talking all this touchy-feely hippie stuff. What's good? I got a robe on. Although I'm still wearing shoes. I was going to bring sandals to go with all this, but, you know, it's 40 and rainy here. You know, I can wear sandals in January in Colorado. You might not realize that. It was 65 last week. Somebody here in Redmond said to me when they heard I was coming, they're like, oh, are you looking forward to coming to where it's warm? You don't understand. It's 40 and rainy there until May. It's 65 and sunny here. So, all right, so this is going to change the way your teams work. It's going to change the way you work. It's going to change the way you come together as a group. Finding this passion point. And different people are motivated differently. Some people are motivated in that way by money, right? They'll get really excited about making the company make the next $1 billion, the next market share, or crushing the competition. Some people, they see a different perspective. Help them find that perspective, and you will get much better results out of them. Okay? All right. It might surprise you to hear me make a statement like this. Given that I work for a tools company, I work on tools, I sell tools, and you've probably seen me present at conferences where I'm trying to sell you my tools. Okay? I do actually think tools are important. Jim said, I helped Jim do a class at the University of Washington yesterday, and he said tools weren't important. And I said, I disagree. They are important. They're not the most important thing. Okay? We're humans. We're tool users. Sorry. But they cannot be the most important thing. The end is not the tool. Are you gonna try to correct yourself now? I saw you stand up. Huh?
I should defend myself.
All right.
I said tools support the process, own the process.
You opened with tools are not important, and then you said tools will support the process. So we're okay now. All right. Right? Every tool that you use should add value to what you're doing. Does anybody know what this thing is? It looks like a wine cork. Like, when I first saw it, I was like, did they stick a wine bottle through the bottom of a pot? I'm really confused here. And then I went and read about it, right? It's an autonomic saucier. Okay? So you got your little pot with your little sauce on it, on the burner, and you put that thing in there, and you turn it on, and it goes and stirs your sauce. Right? I would say that is adding value to the final product, because I can go do something else now. Right? It's over there making my sauce. Now, if it screws it up and maybe over-whips it, and I have to start coming back to it every 30 seconds to make sure it hasn't screwed it up, all right, maybe it's not helping me anymore. All right, I have to constantly return to it and constantly maintain it and constantly babysit it, you know, like a flaky build server or a bad set of unit tests or 3 dozen other things that we all deal with every day in software development. And yes, I will say it, absolutely, any tool that is not adding value to your product, delete it. You might be surprised how many times I have gone to development teams and heard them talking about issues with their tests, and I tell them to delete them. A test that is not giving you value back should be deleted. A tool that is not giving you value back should be deleted. Code that is not contributing value to your product should be deleted. Didn't quite go to the people who are not delivering value to the product. How does that phrase work, Jim? Inside or outside, you choose. So anything at all that does not add value. Kitchen tools are so much fun, right? When you can imagine when I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do on this slide, I just go searching for cool kitchen tools. And you find all kinds of great stuff, right? I mean, they are just nuts for tools in the kitchen space. But they're kind of like us because, in fact, most of them you really don't need. Most of them really don't add value. They're neat, right? But they really aren't as often as valuable to the whole process, to the whole final delivery of what you're doing, as they might seem to be initially. And so don't spend the money on that, or if you have it, give it to your neighbor, give it to your mother-in-law. Here, look at this great thing I have. I love my mother-in-law. I would never do that. Sorry? Yes, yes, I just realized we're recording, so I better cover. Yeah, cover, cover. All right. When we, you know, tools, Jim said tools should be supportive of the process, and I think he's right. I would say tools should be supportive of the objective, right? Tools should be supportive of the delivery of the product, of the job we're trying to do, right? So we're having fun. We see the long road. We're planning the short road. We're passionate and engaged. We care. You know, we're excited. You know what's funny about tools is that any tool that doesn't, like any tool that creates friction, a pain point, a paper cut, starts to take away from those other things. You stop having fun because the tool pisses you off every day. Right? You stop being passionate and engaged because the tool is just making you angry. You know, how can I care about the end road when this thing crashes on me every 4 minutes? Right?
So do you think that the alternate is also true? That when you're feeling pain or friction, that you should reach out or build something?
All right, so let me repeat that for everybody, because there's no way Jim's going to get down here. Because I'm not sure he's paying attention. The question was, you know, is the alternate true, right? If you're feeling pain, should you look for a tool to resolve it? I think we as software developers are inherently and instinctively tool makers. I think that's just what we are and what we do. I think we will always go looking for a tool to solve a problem, right? My wife says sometimes I need to stop being a fixer and be a listener. Because I can't, you know, every time I see something, I start looking for how to fix it, how to find the right way, change this, change that, we'll do this, process, tools, everything. I can, you know, I'll just go, right? And I think we will always look for tools, and that's both to our benefit and our detriment. I think it's to our benefit because when we find good tools, when we develop the right tools, when we buy the right tools, when somebody else makes the right tools, whatever it takes, what happens is we get that burst of excitement of, yay, I got through that, now I get to put that behind me, and the fun comes back, the excitement comes back, everything comes back, right? You feel really good when you make that successful. Or maybe you author something, or you script something, or whatever it was. But when you get it wrong, well, now we go back the other way again. So I think we are all going to look for tools, regardless of whether I would say it's good or bad. The trick is to apply this kind of a rule to it. If it's not adding value, I think, to your end result, if it's not adding value to your final product, it shouldn't be there.
By the way, Peter, when you asked if I was going to run down there, I had my head in a crappy tool. Okay. Trying to figure out what was going on. So.
All right. Well, you can return to the crappy tool, and I'll just keep repeating questions. You sure? All right. Best thing about these cool laptops that, like, spin and turn and whatnot is I need to do that. See? So I can see my little reminder screen. That's why I keep sneaking back there, and I don't have to anymore. So I'm going to take a little bit of a turn here and kind of tangent off for a minute, because I think there's another aspect of kind of team cohesion and efficiency and working together, staying in the groove, that is really important. And of course, it's simplicity. But I find that anytime I talk about simplicity, I have to always qualify it. So that's why I haven't clicked the slide yet. You have to always qualify simplicity. Doesn't mean stupid, okay? A lot of people just assume when they hear simple that we're talking about basic or incomplete or easy or lazy, right? Simple does not mean stupid, right? I like the way simple is defined in the second page of the Agile Manifesto that nobody ever looks at. Which, you know, that simplicity is the art of maximizing the amount of work not done. Okay? That's simplicity. That's simple. Scott Ambler, I think he coined this term, just barely good enough. I like that one. I think that's pretty good. Right? And he argues that, in fact, just barely good enough is, in fact, the most effective possible. That's the right place to be. And that's kind of an interesting approach. And then you need to now take this idea of simple but not stupid, and start to apply it across all of the things we have. In fact, the idea of throwing away tools that give you problems is actually just kind of a special case of this, right? Yes?
I wonder if I could challenge just barely good enough for
okay.
It's certainly possible to write a piece of code that does exactly what you want and no more, and maybe it's not as readable as it could be or as elegant as it could be, and maybe that's good enough. But I often find that in the process of refining it, simplifying it and making it more elegant, that I discover things that are useful. I discover mm-hmm. new abstractions or new way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't always think that just stopping when it's barely good enough is always the best strategy.
So the comment was that if you do just the bare minimum to achieve the story, for example, that in fact there probably is still stuff to do that is going to be value additive. That's the argument basically. And you'll discover that sometimes by investigation and by getting into that code and by playing around with it. I don't disagree with you, in fact. In fact, I don't think Scott Ambler would, in fact, disagree with you on this one. I'm going to jump ahead and then jump back just so you can see what. So this is actually from Scott, right? He's not saying that there isn't any continued value as you keep going, but he's saying that the amount of value is now in decline. Okay? So it's constantly, you know, in ascension all the way up to you hit that point. And as soon as it starts to decline, you now have crossed the threshold. You now have gone past just barely good enough. Now, there still is value beyond that line, but it's in decline. And so that's what he means when he says maximum effectiveness, right? Bang for the buck is the argument. Now, it could be that, in fact, your stories, your requirements, the world around your code changes, in which case that line now moves to the right. The hip climbs up again. It's got a new place. But for anything you're doing, there is this. Now, I want to go back because this idea of simple but not stupid is actually, I think, also kind of what you're saying there, right? Because there is an application of this that is the naive application, right? And if you've read any of the books on test-driven development and you follow what they guide you through, right? Remember, these are intentionally created examples designed to help you understand the processes of test-driven development. And so they'll have you do this thing, you know, where it says, you know, return null and then run the tests, or throw and then run the tests. Okay? This is clearly a naive, unrealistic approach. However, right, in the books and in the guides and the examples, the intent there is to show you this constant, never-ending stepwise motion that TDD entails, right? When you get to applying stuff really in your code and get to actually doing work, you might not choose to always do the what you would call the stupid thing. And doing the stupid thing is not simple. Okay? There is a careful balance between simple and stupid. And I want you all to think about, I see you with that. I want you all to think about that this isn't just about code. It's easy to apply, it's easier because we spend all of our time talking about this, applying this to design. We can talk about simplicity from a design perspective, and we can talk about the solid design principles and all those other great things. But in fact, you want to take this across the board, this approach, this idea of maximizing the amount of work not done, and this idea of, you know, just in time, just enough, just barely good enough. All right, I see you got a mic.
Yes. Good morning, Peter. Going back to the just barely good enough and the value, one of the things that was brought up...
Do you want the chart back?
It's fine. Either or. Going back to the second keynote this morning, one of the things that was brought up was that local optimizations are to the detriment of global optimizations. So I agree. For a given user story, for a given delivery within a sprint, that chart applies, that statement applies. But where I take issue is if one looks over the entire enterprise over a period of years... what additional investments there that didn't pay off on that work item, on that user story, but what they pay off to the entire company over a 3-5 year period mm-hmm. can be tremendously huge, not shown there.
Absolutely.
And so in the long run, that's can be the better choice. That's enough.
Yes. So I completely agree with you. And I would add, let me extend. And they can be the most destructive thing ever to come into your company. Right? So now so these things that are going to go broad and big and effective, this is kind of that long-term, short-term thing again, right? I'm admitting there's some balancing here. But those kinds of things can be massively detrimental to your enterprise because suddenly they hit all 1,000 people every single day. And so if it doesn't hit that magic payoff, right? We know there's that magic payoff, kind of like winning the lottery, right? When you get that, man, that was worth it. 10 years of hell, but it was worth it. Except for the other 47 times that we still haven't been paid off and we've been doing it for 10 years. I think this is the kind of balance that we need to be careful about. We need to be watching very carefully for when, you know, the opportunity for the payout, right, versus the actuality of the payout, right? I think you can even imagine running odds on it. You can run probabilities and odds, right? We know what the probabilities are of winning the lottery. We can then start to make, you know, assertions about what the probabilities will be that this process change, this technique, this design that's going to cost us, this style of test, whatever it might be, is going to pay out over the long run. We actually probably can make, it might be a rule of, you know, about 30, right? And there's probably a place where you say, you know, that's just not good enough. It's not worth it. It's going to cost me too much. It's going to take too much effort. So there is this interesting, you know, thing as you look at this about the tipping over point at that line. It does change. It moves. It for everything that you consider, it's different. It's in a different place. At different points in time of your project, it's in a different place, right? Just barely good enough today is not just barely good enough tomorrow, right? And this is kind of that whole simple local thing. So I agree with what you're saying. I'm just saying there is this point we got to be real careful about.
Completely agree with everything. Just to add onto
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. That's good. It's really good stuff.
Based upon my experiences, it's not maybe they can be calculated, but those odds can, not certainties, but odds can be predicted. This has this percentage mm-hmm. payoff, those percentage payoffs, and you can hit pretty close to the odds. So, yes, the odds of winning at Lotto, close enough to zero, but the payoff, tremendous.
Yep.
Putting down 35 chips on a roulette wheel, the odds of winning, very high. Payout is small. Risk of, if you do lose, is a horrible loss. Losing a dollar in Lotto, not so bad. So it's a whole trade-off, and it is looking at the odds,
yeah.
looking at what your risk-benefit is over
Absolutely.
To the company, looking at where you're willing to invest. But
I think more often than not, if I can just return us now back to the idea of this team and us and, you know, kind of in the small, where I'm focused. I'm focused on agile developers, small teams, us, you know, six or seven of us together working on building something. There are things that we will do inside of our own code base that we will do while we're developing that take us far beyond this line with respect to the things that we have responsibility for. As we get into those other worlds, we're almost always leaving that local team environment and we're extending out beyond. I would say that for those things that have a direct impact on the team, like you need to design the code to include an extensibility model for blah so that we can leverage it over the... That's a user story. That's a requirement. I should know about that. So, of course, I'll design against it. It goes left of the line. Right? Because it's part of the required but bit of the value. But when it's not, and we're just doing it for because we like to, or because we want to, or because it feels right, well, now we've gone beyond simplicity, and we're starting to gold plate or maybe silver plate if you're just being a little bit over.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, there's this interesting thing I've been thinking about and I've been collecting notes on for years now. I did a talk at the Norwegian Developers Conference 4 or 5 years ago, and then I did it again the following year at Agile Conference that I called the butterfly effect, but in fact is more accurately just a restatement of the law of unintended consequences as applied to software development. Okay? Does anybody know the idea of the Streisand effect? You heard of this? That's what this picture is. This is the picture that was the lawsuit picture. Let me tell you the story. So some guy on a helicopter went off and was taking pictures of the coast in California and, you know, looking for like, things about erosion and things like that. You can see clearly this cliff is moving towards that house, right? And he was doing all this, and he was like, hey, look at Barbara Streisand's gigantic house, right? And he published it as part of his report and up on the website, and somebody linked to it and said, hey, look at Barbara Streisand's gigantic house. Okay, Barbara Streisand sued the guy for invasion of privacy and tried to get all the pictures taken down off the internet. The unintended consequence, of course, is that now this picture is everywhere, right? And I just added to that list by another couple hundred people who have seen it. Okay, so clearly her intention was to have nobody see this picture and every day more people are seeing the picture. Honestly, if she'd left it alone, it would have sat in that research study and nobody would have cared, right? Anything that hurts or scares people will cause them to react. Okay? And I told you I've been kind of collecting these up over the years, and I have kind of a whole bunch of interesting ones, so I'm just going to peek over here at some of my little written down parts that I've observed. And some of them are really interesting because they almost seem counter to some of the things that we have historically thought about agile software development, or perhaps misunderstandings about things. One of my favorite ones is never break the build, right? We've all heard never break the build? Yeah? Yeah, it's crap, okay? It was intentionally shortened to like fit in four words. But it's wrong. It's not never break the build. Because if you take never break the build to its not even very far conclusion, it means breaking the build gets, you know, the chicken hung on your door, gets the toilet seat in your office, gets you yelled at by the boss, gets you embarrassed, gets you ashamed, gets you frustrated. And what happens? You stop checking in. You stop building. You start self-imposing all kinds of extra taxes on yourself to make sure you don't get the toilet seat in your office. Right? That was not what they meant. What they really meant is, don't ever leave the build broken. If you break it, fix it right now. It's okay to break it. It's no big deal. We do it all the time. Don't leave it. Checking in at 5 and sprinting to your car. No. Okay? Checking in at 5, waiting for the build to finish, seeing it go green. Okay. Checking in at 5, waiting for the build to finish, seeing it go red. All right, now you got a choice. If you really need to run to your car, back out that change. Okay? That's really what they meant. Don't ever put the shared repository that we all share and use together in a state where anybody else cannot check it out and build it and get positive results. That's just too many words, though. So they shortened it down, don't break the build. And then somebody heard don't break the build, and they went off that other direction, and suddenly we got toilet seats. This is wrong, okay? And there's other ones that are very interesting about unintended consequences, right? I mean, do any of you guys work in an environment where you have check-in gates? And I don't mean the TFS thing. I mean, you have something. No, it might be the TFS thing, but you have something that is a way of saying you cannot check in unless you. Right, finish the sentence here. Might be an automated system, might be self-imposed. These are the same. In fact, don't break the build is a check-in gate. Right, it immediately becomes a check-in gate, and check-in gates slow you down. They'll slow you down. They will get then. What happens is when people check in less frequently, they check in bigger. And when they check in bigger, it becomes harder for anybody else to check in because the merges get bigger. Okay? So then because it gets harder to check in, you get afraid of checking in, so you slow down even more. And you end up with 1 and 2 day merges at the end of your sprint for each guy. This is insane. I much prefer the approach I heard. There was a couple of guys working on an open source project, and they were, you know, going off to some venture capitalist meeting. I don't remember all the names, and I should. And you know, they were like up at late at night in their hotel room the night before, hacking on the code they were working on. And the guy made an interesting comment that he just kind of flew right past and didn't like poke on for a minute, but I thought it was great, which was, we were racing to check in ahead of each other because the guy who checks in first doesn't have to merge. Right? And so the two of them were like, check, check in, check in, check in, check in, right? And they were both doing that. You know the cool thing about it? I bet you neither one of them ever had to merge all night. Or if you did, it's only one line. Right? We're not talking about this change set of 300 files where 200 of them changed. No. It's right. That just shows that we want to be fast. We want to be able to do that. So we got to get these things that are having the unintended consequence of the negative behavior out of the way, because ultimately people are just reacting to the stuff that hurts. They don't like that. It's not fun. So let's see. Here's another one that I really like. Team, and these are actually collected from talking to customers telling me their own stories. Because after I mention that I collect these things, there's always a couple people, there probably will be today, who come up and say, here's one you haven't heard before. And here's one I got at a conference. The team had decided that they had these really long methods and they wanted to break them down. So the rule became you couldn't have any methods more than some number lines long. Okay? So they actually ended up with a whole bunch of different methods that were like, you know, render the page underscore one, render the page underscore two, render this page underscore three, render the page underscore four, and at the first, and then render the page called one, two, three, four. You guys heard of Michael Feathers? Working effectively with legacy code, genius TD guy, and super nice guy anyway. I was telling him this story. He was like, you know, it's probably better anyway. It's clearly not right, but it's probably better. Those four, yeah, those are, that's better. It's not right, like you're not done, but that's better than where you were. His point was, you know, a 400-line method. So I thought this was an interesting one, because I was totally in this position of, you know, the unintended consequence of people acting stupid about their refactoring. He was like, no, at least they did some. Okay, fair enough. But you want to think that through, right? You want to think that through and think about the unintended consequences that are going to occur. Think about how it's going to affect your team and their behavior. And if it anything that becomes a pain point for your people, they're just going to go around it. We are instinctive. We're all good, really good at avoiding pain. Right? You put a little hot thing over there, and I just do this, right? You put something annoying in front of me in the build, in the tooling, in the process, anything, and I'm just going to go right around it. We can promise we won't. We can put, you know, punishments if we don't, all those other things. That's not going to help. We're still going to go right around it. So be thinking about that. Here's the last one. Is a team that self-imposed. Again, this is what's fun. I love the self-imposed ones because it's really easy to find the ones where you get to blame it on the management. Damn management, right? But when they self-impose them, you got nobody to blame but yourself. So this team had self-imposed the idea that they were going to increase their code coverage by 5% every sprint. Okay? And they did. They did. And they ended up with lots and lots of tests that didn't test anything. Because, Jim, what's the best way to increase code coverage in your code base?
Write tests that don't have asserts in them. So you just exercise the code.
They run the code. They don't assert. They never fail. Because, of course, can't break the build. Right? So they never fail. But, hey, look at that code coverage report. 100%. Yeah. Well, you can't go 5% up from there. But, you know, we're good now, right? And clearly it would have been better to have people thinking about writing more good tests. These metrics can be very dangerous, right? Think about metrics. Carefully. We're tool guys, right? We talked about this. Tool guys, and we're math people and sciencey people, and so measuring and calculating and equations and formulas and algorithms, we want all this. This is great. So we start counting things and measuring things and differencing things and analyzing them in summary and put them in Excel, and right? And you know what happens is eventually somebody uses it the way it wasn't intended, somebody gets bonked on the head, and everybody starts changing their behavior, okay? Do any of you track actuals versus estimates? Come on, don't be afraid. Okay. So I actually love the idea of tracking actuals versus estimates, provided nobody but the people on the team can see the data. Okay? Because the moment somebody on the team can see the data, you get this pointy-haired boss from Dilbert coming into your office and saying, I think we need to work on improving your team's estimation accuracy. Because I've noticed that your team tends to be about half, their estimates tend to be about half of their actual costs consistently and regularly time over time. So we're going to have to do something about that. Right? That was a very polite way of getting yelled at. Okay. And now what do? Before I type my estimates into the tool, I double them. And now I'm not having an honest conversation with my stakeholder, with the rest of my team, with anybody, but I'm avoiding getting smacked. Be very careful about metrics. Think about what you want to do with them. Think about what the action that you will do with them is before you get carried away with them. They're very powerful tools, and you know, as they say, with great power comes great responsibility. And they are the single biggest, if I look through my whole collection of all these stories, most of them are about abuse of metrics. And yet I like metrics, I'm acknowledging they're a little sketchy. So motivating to succeed. I really do firmly believe Dan Pink got it right. I've been playing around with this stuff now for a couple years after reading his book the first time, and kind of watching what works with people and what doesn't. Right, I'm a pointy-haired manager type now, so I get to do these kinds of things. Run experiments on people. That's what managers do, right? I think when he said autonomy, mastery, and purpose, really what he was acknowledging is that, in fact, your average Joe wants to do things they like to do. So all the other stuff I've said is actually the same as this, right? They want to know that they want to know the long road. They want to feel passionate. They want to care about it. It's purpose, right? They want to, be able to do just in time and this, that, and the next thing, and they want to care about what they're doing, and that's, autonomy and mastery. Right? We need to empower and trust people to make the decisions that we want them to make. This is an interesting thing to think about. Or if any of you managers, I am, so I can keep my hand up. Okay, managers of people, like you're directly responsible for them. In theory, you could fire them. Okay. This is an interesting thing I've observed, and as I've been kind of coming to grips with myself as a manager now, is that every time you go to one of your direct reports and override a decision they made, right? What you did is you just put a little tally mark on the side of the chart in his mind that says, don't make decisions. And every time you do it, he does it again. Tick, tick, tick. And pretty soon, they won't make decisions anymore. They will stop. Oh, sorry, got to check my boss. Anybody know that guy? Nope, can't do that, got to check my boss. Right? What are you here for? We are all here to make decisions. That's actually what we're here for. We are making decisions about changing code. We are making decisions about fulfilling requirements. We are making decisions about delivering products. That's what we're here for. Yes, the decision making gets precisely cut down into smaller and smaller chunks all the way down to the guy who decides what letters to type. But you cannot disempower people from making decisions. And that autonomy is something people have to feel good about themselves. And if you take it away, they will stop. And then you will lose all those things I talked about at the beginning. You won't have any of them anymore. There's this other thing about giving them the opportunity to improve and grow their craft. I'm sure you guys have heard of flex time and 5% time and FedEx days and ship it awards, ship it days, and all these other things. We've started doing a ship it days, FedEx days thing on our teams, and we absolutely love it. The teams love it. It's funny, we can choose to do like this morale event where we go tubing, or we can do a FedEx days. Okay, if you ask people, they'll say tubing. At the end of it, if you were to look at like morale change by just talking to people, FedEx days every time. You're getting some time to grow your craft and code and play and have a good time hacking on something that you just because you want to do it, not because the boss told you to, right? That is a great thing. And you've got to give people those opportunities, training and everything else that they want to in order to grow their craft and in order to, increase their mastery. And that purpose thing, I think I've beat on it enough already, right? They've got to have it. And if you take it away, you're not going to get anything productive. There's some interesting demotivators that are kind of come to bear here on occasion. An estimate is an estimate, not a contract. It's kind of related to that estimate actual thing we talked about just a minute ago. Right? Yeah, it's going to take me about 3 days. At the end of 3 days, if you come to me and say, where is it? You told me 3 days. No, it wasn't a contract. I told you it was going to take about 3 days. I'll be done with it tomorrow. Nope, need to have it today. Stay all night. I'm just going to double next time. Right? We're back here again. Death marching at the end of the sprint. Don't do it, right? Meetings that don't deliver value. Every meeting you do should deliver value. What's interesting is that the meetings we have in Agile, stand-ups and scrums and planning meetings, done well, contribute to these things in a positive light, and done poorly, they take away. Get them wrong, they're negative. Like, it's not even zero, it's negative. So that's this interesting thing we got to be thinking about. And of course, retrospectives, we all know that we should be doing them, even though most of us actually don't do them very well. Be very, very cautious, especially you managery types who raised your hand, or team leads or whatever. Never shoot the messenger. Because it's just like that other one, right? Guy raises his hand and says, I really don't like that we have to do this. Oh, well, you're wrong, blah, 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 blah. It's not going to raise my hand next time. I'm done with that. Right? The guy sits there quietly for all the retrospectives from here on out. So, we're in the business of delivering customer value, right? there's this interesting thing about outcomes versus processes. I've always found it amusing that, you know, the Agile Manifesto says people over processes and tools. Probably got the phrasing exact, not quite right, but you know what I mean? And yet, of course, all those guys went on to write process books and form companies that did process and trained and sold and created certifications and all this other stuff, right? Including the guy who didn't go.
That's right.
Yep.
Didn't go to the meeting.
Didn't go to the meeting, or else you'd be on it too. Right? We know that what we care about is the delivery of software, the delivery of value. All the things I've been talking about are about delivering value, right? That's what we're here for. Whether we are in the business of delivering customer products, like consumer-facing apps, line-of-business apps, apps that only make the CFO happy, whatever, right? That's our job. We're here to deliver that piece of software. The processes that you use, just like the tools, should be supportive of you achieving that. So you want to care mostly about that outcome, okay? An interesting way to think about that is, you know, historically for a very long time now, IT departments, except perhaps in product companies that actually deliver products, IT departments are considered a cost center, right? They go on the bad side of the budget sheet, right? It's like paying rent. We got to have IT guys. I would like to see us try to get businesses to think about us as being business differentiators, contributors. We contribute value back to the business because everything we do adds value. That's the where we want to be. Nobody wants to be a cost center. It's not a fun place. It's hard to have purpose there too. Interestingly enough, though, and then I'll wrap it up here. I found when I was doing a little bit of research on this, a guy named Bruce Mao wrote a thing called the Incomplete Manifesto, and it's hard to dig up because you only find people referencing to it because he took the page down. but it said, when outcomes drive the process, and he's saying the opposite of this, by the way. When outcomes drive the process, we will only go where we've already been. If process drives the outcomes, we may not know where we're going, but we will know that we want to be there. I thought that was interesting. I haven't quite figured out how I want to take that into myself and use it. But because I think I see his point that you should want to go grow and get better. But I don't think that necessarily means that the process is more important than the outcome. I think what he's really failing to say is that there's another outcome he wants. Right? I think when you look at it that way, it actually does then become outcomes or what we care about and not all of these other things. All right, so the clock is ticking. Jim's picking his mic up. I want to thank you guys for letting me ramble on at you for an hour. And thank you for coming to Redmond and joining us for this conference. And have a great rest of your time.
Thanks, Peter.
Do you want to take a couple of questions?
I'm happy to take questions if people want.
Could you go back to the Dan Pink slide?
Yeah. I'm happy to take questions. Why, did somebody want to ask a question about Dan Pink?
Yeah, does he have pink hands?
Well, it's a lighting thing. Come on now. Did anybody have any questions, comments? They want to tell me I'm crazy and dumb?
Okay, I'm ready. Hi. You said one thing about not overriding a teammate's decision, or actually no. A team member's decision.
It's not quite what I said, but keep going.
My problem is, what if he actually did really make a bad decision? That needs to be overridden.
No, that's fine. I guess my point is, you just need to acknowledge that every time you, and it's teammates, I would actually argue you're safer than the manager relationship. That manager relationship is interesting. It's like the parental relationship, right? You're perceived differently in their mind. You're not stored as a friend and peer. You're stored as the guy who can fire me and make me miss my mortgage payment, okay? And so when that guy says to you, wrong, you pull a tick mark up, right? Because if I do this too many times, I'm not going to make my mortgage payment, right? But of course, if he follows it up with, next time you make a great decision, nice work. Okay, I get to put a tick mark on this side. We're balanced again, right? That's the thing that I'm really pointing out, is make sure that you don't get into a position where your vetoes, your overrides, put this person in a position where they feel disempowered from making decisions. We need people to be in a position to make decisions. We need to make good decisions. So we need to educate them and help them make better decisions. But when you just override every single thing, after enough times, they will just stop. That was the point I was making. So thank you for clarifying that. Anybody else? I got one over here. I guess I can take my robe off now. Although if I do, I think I'll have to turn back into the Microsoft guy.
I like what you said about metrics, but I often see metrics being used for project management instead of quality. But how do you convince your managers and up that that's not what they're there for?
I prefer just not to tell them that I have them in the first place. Now, that seems slightly not transparent and dishonest. Guilty. I think what I'm acknowledging is, it's that whole paper cut pain thing, right? I'm defending myself from something in advance. I know it's going to happen, so I just defend myself from it now. I think some people in the position of managerial stakeholder authority over top of a project, over project, top of a team, you can educate them. You can talk to them about it, right? And you know if you can or if you can't. I know which of my upper people I can have this kind of a conversation with and which I can't. And so when I can, I try to explain to them why I think them asking for this from me is wrong.
Yeah, so confront them with the consequences.
Well, I talk to them. If we do that, here's what's going to happen. And there's nothing we can do to prevent this unintended consequence from happening. It will happen. All of us will start lying on our estimates, right? My people are going to lie to me, and therefore I'm going to be lying to you, and I don't even know I'm doing it, right? This is how it's going to work. So let's not do that. If you're in a position where you can't get them to back away, well, unfortunately, we know where that's going to go, right?
We have time for one more question.
So. There was one.
Back. Where?
I saw one here. I thought there was one on the way back. He's already asked two, though.
You asked one already.
Okay, right. You can tell him while they're handing the mic back.
Just
right at the back.
Lead time. Don't give him anything else.
Yeah.
Okay, because I only get one question, it's a compound question.
Give me a three-parter.
What is a FedEx day and... What do you find you're more productive because you stand up when you program?
All right, so that's the question about FedEx days and the question about the stand-up desk. All right, let me see. FedEx days is a term that was coined by Atlassian to describe the idea was that you have 24 hours from start to finish to deliver, just like Federal Express. They have since stopped calling it FedEx days, and I suspect it's due to trademark problems. They now call it Ship It Days. Okay, but we all know roughly what we're talking about. It goes something like this. Whole team stops work at noon. We get together in a conference room. Explain to people the rules. Make up an idea. Form yourself up in little teams. Go. See you here tomorrow at noon. Come back in the room at noon the next day. Demo what you did. All right, all the demos done? Vote. Who had the coolest one? Give them a trophy. Our trophy looks like a little pig. Not kidding. It's literally a little pig on a little stand. It's really cool. We thought the pigs and chickens metaphor still applied, right? David Starr educated me that it doesn't anymore. So that's what FedEx Days is. FedEx Days, Ship It Days, same. Now, the stand-up desk. There's actually a bunch of reasons you might want to or not do a stand-up desk. For me, it makes my back feel better. It gets me moving around a little bit because otherwise I'll just spend, every waking hour of my day sitting down. And it's probably better for me not to. Also, you've seen me up here. I pace, I wander, I do this, right? And so here I am in a room all by myself on a video call. I told you 6+ hours a day. And what was happening is I would stand up and I'd pace and then I'd go back and I'd sit down again. And my chair is rattling around and I'm bonking into the chair. And if I'm going to be doing this anyway, I may as well just start off standing up. I do have a tall chair. So if my legs get tired and I just need a break, I can slide the tall chair over and still be at that height. But it's nice. That desk is this high. Right. You do this with you stand like this, do this, that's the spot your desk should be. Right? And I built it up out of all crazy IKEA parts that were never meant to go together that way, but it was fun. All right, thank you guys
very much.
Thanks,
Peter.
Anything, Matthew?
I just gotta make sure that my laptop's on the screen.
So. I built a stand up workbench like that one time.
Yeah.
But because I'm 6'8", nobody else could use it.